joining us to share his insights on the market. Martin Armstrong, author of The Greatest Bull Market in History, Economic Confidence Model, founder of Princeton Economics, subject of the must-see movie, The Forecaster. How's the weather in Florida today, Martin?
Bright, sunny, nice, still snowing down south in New Zealand. So I've kind of picked a middle spot. Yeah, no, we didn't get any, the record heat that is hitting, hit the northern states and even Texas. I mean, so we never got any days that were even, I think the highest we had was like 93, 94 or something.
Hey, that's not bad at all for Florida.
No, I know. Everybody thinks, oh, Florida is much hotter. No, it's not. It's actually hotter up in New Jersey. I'm up by Tampa. You go down to Miami, it's very, very humid. And the same thing you get with in Tokyo in August. I mean, when I would work and just have to walk simply maybe 8 blocks to the office, they'd have to send a car to come pick me up, because if I walked it, by the time I got there, I needed a shower.
So what do you think of Tokyo? I mean, I've always heard the best things about living, if you can afford it.
It's kind of like being in the 50s in the sense that it's extremely polite. Nobody would ever steal anything from you. But you have to keep in mind that Tokyo itself was destroyed mostly in 1923 by the tsunami and the earthquake. So most of it is modern. If you want, to see the classical Japanese tower, type tiers of castles and things like that, you have to go to Kyoto or Nara or something like that. You don't really find that in Tokyo itself.
Exactly. Just don't upset your local Yakuza.
Well, yeah. Well, they tend to be more interested in going after the corporations where they get big money.
How long have you really been following the markets? I know you started off, trading, selling precious metals and coins and numismatics. But when did you just finally say, hey, I'm going to follow the markets? I'd like to know how many decades you've been doing this.
Basically, from the mid-70s. It started actually with the Franklin National Bank. One of my clients back then happened to be one of the executive vice presidents, and this was just starting into the floating exchange rate, the crisis there in the mid-70s. He called me in, he says, you understand all this trading stuff, maybe I think we got a problem here. And they lost, basically the bank on 7% move in the Italian lira. They didn't teach this stuff. And they still don't teach it in school. I mean, I was asked if I would be interested in teaching it over at Cambridge University. And I said, excuse me? I said, don't think I really want to go teach class. I said, why are you asking me? And because largely they have nobody in any of these universities teaching anything about the world economy. Floating exchange rates, they're still teaching all the old theories from Keynesianism and Bretton Woods. I mean, sorry, but we're not on a fixed exchange rate anymore.
Well, let's move on then to the Fed. Our favorite policymakers have obviously about 94% probabilities of raising rates to 2.25 this week, I guess Wednesday, September 26th. Dr. Copper picked up on that last week, up 8% in a single week. What do you think this means for the commodities sector?
Just basically following at this stage in the game, the real commodity cycle will probably kick in after 2020. But what we have to understand is, what Janet Yellen was actually yelling about all the time, that we have to normalize interest rates. And people just don't get what that means. I mean, all your pension funds, et cetera, are going belly up because most of them needed 8% to break even. You got California looking to put in more taxes because CalPERS is below par. You have the same problem in Illinois, New Jersey. I mean, you name it, it's everywhere.
The thing about copper, though, is we tend to see it outperform much of the rest of the commodities index, the CRB, when economic conditions are robust. From what I've read now, we're seeing low stockpiles in China and increased demand. Do you think that might mean that conditions are a little stronger than people expect?
Well, you do have more or less the issue with commodities is that they are dominated in dollars. So as the dollar goes up, that also makes the commodities rise faster of their currency terms. So it creates the illusion of a bull market and inflation, but you have to understand the currency play. During the 1970s, I happen to like sports cars. I bought a Porsche in 1970 for like $20,000. By the time you got to 1980, that car was about a $60,000 car. And it created the image that, oh, you know, German cars are better, they appreciate, they hold their value, etc. And no, it was just the fact that the dollar was going down. They priced their cars in Deutschmark at the time. So the price kept rising. The way the Japanese beat the Germans and coming in with Toyotas, etc., they priced it in dollars and then took the currency risk home. So they were able to beat the Germans in the market. It's all a currency play. So as the dollar goes up, when you have commodities in dollars, what happens is it makes it look more like a bull market in China than it does in the United States.
The dollar had every opportunity from a technical perspective, the Fed about to raise rates and then again in December, and maybe a couple more times early next year, maybe not. There was quite a sell-off last week that I think may have injured its chance of making new highs in 2019. What do you think that means for the markets?
The dollar is still going to go up and make new highs into probably 2020, as late as 2021, and then turn. Honestly, in the 40 years I've been in this game, this is the worst I have ever seen it in my entire life. You usually have some political chaos in one place, and money moves to a quieter place. Right now, we've got chaos in absolutely everywhere. You go to Europe, you've got Italy, Greece, you've got Britain, looking at a hard exit. You've got the political nonsense going on here with Trump and really a deep state attempt at a coup. Everything is, there isn't a single place that's not going nuts. So it's not as easy as it was 20 years ago, honestly. The dollar is still just in the consolidation period. I don't see it as making any kind of a major decline. In order for it to decline, you'd have to have, say, all right, fine, it means confidence in Europe is going to rise, or Britain, or side the United States, and it's just not there. If anything, this is why the stock market's going up, because the real smart money and the big money is, they can't buy gold, 1 ounce bars and stuff like that. They can't do that. They basically, their only means of survival is the equity side.
So folks are earning higher relative rate between, let's just say, the yuan or the yen or the pound sterling. Obviously, the money flows are going to favor U.S. equities because the dividend is outstanding, pretty solid economic growth. Do you see that persisting for the next few years?
Yeah, I mean, largely this is the collapse in confidence in government. It's systemic. It's everywhere you look. It's more than just a debt crisis that we have. It is complete incompetence in managing the fiscal estate everywhere. You get these people who are calling for hyperinflation because of the Fed, etc. They don't even understand what they're talking about. I mean, we are probably one of the largest institutional advisors. So it's the big money that we have to deal with. I can tell you what they were doing, okay? You had, fine, everybody's saying, oh, the Fed, $4 trillion, it's going to be, hyperinflation. Then you look at what did the Fed do? The banks complained, so they created excess reserves. And excess reserves went up to almost $3 trillion, okay? So the money doesn't go out into the system. Plus, these ideas are so antiquated. It's absurd. The Fed, we're going to buy in 30-year bonds, and that will stimulate the economy. These are ideas from the 17th century.
Even with these much higher relative interest rates on the Fed, plus all of our QE, you look at their balance sheet over the St. Louis Fed, I mean, they're really curtailing now. They're down 5%. From the peak, the dollar should have had a more sustained rally, given the relative advantage we've had on a currency basis over the last, let's just say, 2 or 3 years. And the rest of them are starting to talk more dovish, at the ECB and the Bank of Japan and China. It seems like their currencies would gain against the U.S. dollar.
It's a question of confidence. I mean, there are a lot of rumblings behind the scenes here that you take the ECB, major institutions and political sources in Europe, they are screaming in both ears of Draghi that he's got to stop this quantitative easing stuff. He has completely destroyed the European bond market. There's just no bid. I mean, institutions aren't, they're not buying this stuff. They can't. How can a pension fund buy a 10-year bond and get even 2% or 3% when they need 8%? They're locking in a guaranteed loss. Nobody's doing this. All the European banks, or the ECB, what I meant by 17th century ideas, the ECB, oh, we're going to punish banks, we're going to make them negative. If they put their cash here, we're going to charge them to do so. And that will force them to lend money out. No, what did they do? Yeah, they simply used their U.S. branch. They sent all the money over here to the U.S. branch, and the U.S. branch deposited at the Fed. Half of the top 10 banks I speak to personally did that. Politicians, they don't understand what they're doing. The same thing as we're saying with the Fed. Oh, we're going to buy in 30-year bonds. You're assuming only Americans own them. I mean, Japan, you know, had them. I mean, China, they sold most of the 30-year bonds and brought the maturities down to 5 years or less. I mean, and then people, well, gee, there was no hyperinflation. Because it's a very porous global economy. And the ECB could not enforce negative rates over there. The Fed could not stimulate the domestic economy because it's impossible because everything is basically porous on a global scale. So we just need completely new tools. The idea the central bank can actually manage the economy is absurd. And once the major players are confronted with that, you're going to see capital just run. You're looking at confidence in the government and paying attention to Fed numbers and stuff. It's going to collapse.
Where does it run to?
Right now, basically, you get into these periods historically where this time it's the governments that are in trouble. So you run away. You know, basically, you're not going to buy California debt, Illinois, New Jersey, and eventually you won't buy federal debt either. Then there are other times when the private sector's in trouble and you own, and the flight to quality is, oh, you go to government bonds. So it's a cycle. I mean, and this time government has basically gone to the complete limits. That's it. It's absurd. I mean, my sources in Washington, the Democrats, you know, what they want to do, they basically want to get rid of all the Republicans, and they feel they should raise the taxes back to 75%, where they were before all this nonsense with Reagan and Republican lowering taxes.
Well, you remember what happened then, right? I mean, there was capital flight out of the country. Everybody left.
Look, I mean, I told my staff, I said, if it ever gets to that point, I said, I quit. I'm not going to work as an economic slave for them. I'm just not going to do it.
We just heard last Monday that the administration is going to impose a 10% tariff on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports. That's going to increase to 25% by the end of this year. China, of course, retorted on Tuesday, saying they're targeting 5,000 products, about $60 billion, and that'll go into effect next week on that tax. Is this a game changer, or is this a big yawn from your perspective?
I mean, I agree with him on the lowering the taxes, et cetera, and what he has tried to do on trade, most of the press don't really give him any credit. But effectively what he has done in Europe, I know firsthand, he basically, they go, oh, you know, this is a trade war, you know. Well, he threatens to increase taxes. But then he comes back and says, hey, you drop everything and I'll drop everything. You know, and immediately the French go, well, no, we can't do that. So, you know, is he trying to basically raise the stakes to get to free trade? Perhaps. But, you know, tariffs and things of this nature only come back to create inflation, really, because they're just passed on to the consumer. So, and this whole idea of trade is kind of really, it stems from communism, honestly. It's all they care about and all they focus on, oh, is the worker, the worker, the worker. All right. What about the consumer? You know, the consumer should be able to basically increase their lifestyle by, you know, you purchasing, you know, whatever it is, if it's a car or whatever, at the best possible price. You know, and look, New York City used to be all unions, and that was the biggest port for everything coming in. They got very dictatorial, abused their powers, and what happened? There isn't one ship that goes to New York anymore.
Last week, 600 points up on the Dow Jones, approaching 27,000. You went on record saying, hey, we could see 50,000. We could see 100,000 on the Dow if we keep running the way we are. Give us your latest take on why we're at new highs. Is the Dow just playing catch up with the high-tech, high-flying NASDAQ, or could this thing have legs?
You take the Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P. Each one reflects a different category of buyers. When the Dow is leading, it's foreign capital coming in. The foreigner wants the blue chips. They're not going to go buy, you know, startup companies, and that's too risky for them. I mean, just look at when the Japanese came in. What did they buy in real estate? Rockefeller Center, you know, and Chinese do the same thing. They don't go down and, you know, to local streets and buying housing for 150 grand. They're not interested in that. They always want the trophies. And this is what the Dow is. It's the trophies to international capital. So when the Dow is leading all the way up, that's why I kept saying, listen, this is a international capital flows and they're coming into the United States, which is why the Dow was moving up. Now, you had the Dow making new highs, and now NASDAQ did not. The S&P finally just broke through. This is just a staging ground, and the Dow is probably going to go up to our next target around, you know, the high 30,000 area. I mean, there's a possibility we go all the way into like 2032. Now we're looking at, you know, the 60,000 area. But you have to take into consideration what is the dollar and purchasing power at that time.
Martin, did you mean 2022?
It can be as early as 2020 going into like 2022. That's the first period in time, then the second one's out of the 2032. This was the first target for a potential temporary high in 2018. But now that we took out the January high, it's showing a lot more strength at this stage in the game. And this is all political uncertainty that's taking place globally. Where do you put your money at this stage? So if particularly, you know, these people like that are after Trump, they don't get it. They really don't get it. You're undermining the office of the president. This is not a personal, you know, thing that you get to, oh, I don't like him, so let's do whatever we can to get him out. You're talking about changing the foundation of the country. The president of the United States is supposed to be the leader of the free world. Okay, so if you undermine the president, regardless of who it is, all right, you are destabilizing the confidence in the United States globally. Everything will be okay, and we'll get it back to normal. It's not going back to normal. We crossed the Rubicon here. This is it. You know, they don't even understand what's going on. You take the 28-year-old girl, Alexandra, in New York, who they said was the lion killer. You know, she threw her hat in the ring and beat basically a Democrat who was there forever, and they thought he would be the head, you know, the Speaker of the House if they won. Then they were shocked. So instead of saying this is still part of the Trump revolution, which is really just throw out whoever is in out against career politicians, they look at it and say, oh, the people want higher taxes and they want more socialism. That's why they voted for her. This is what's going on. So now the talk is, oh, you know, we should raise taxes back to 75% because this is what the people want. Keeps it all together is confidence. You know, the same thing if you look at, you know, hyperinflation. They go, oh, it's, you know, it was increased in printing of money. That is the most absurd statement I have ever heard. Germany had a communist revolution in 1918. The other hyperinflation was Austria-Hungary. Hungary was the first communist socialist republic after Russia. And then you had Poland. So, excuse me, you've got money in a bank. You're now, and your country is going into a communist revolution, as they did in Russia, and you think you're going to trust the government currency and bonds? I mean, you know, it had nothing to do with printing money. The printing of the money comes as a result of the capital flight. It's not the other way around. And look at Venezuela. They got all the resources, all right? Venezuela's got the biggest oil reserves in the world. It's going through hyperinflation. Why? Because people don't trust the government. If you don't trust the government, it's all, you know, that's the end of the game. So this undermining Trump is part of this process where what we're talking about here is undermining the confidence in governments globally.
Talk about undermining confidence. I mean, you know, the Fed is now pulling back on that $100 billion per month monetary injection into our financial markets. They're taking the Kool-Aid, you know, off the trading floors. Without that QE, what's going to maintain dollar hegemony?
Largely because the dollar is the only game in town. In Europe, the main reason the bunds were doing well is because it was the hedge against everything else. I mean, most of the European institutions were buying the bunds because it was a bet that the euro was going to break, and they thought they would get Deutschmarks. Others hedged their bet and sent it over into U.S. Treasuries. The dollar is still the only place for, you're talking about big capital now, where to park it. I mean, I think we're going to, you know, it's this chaos that creates it, and it's only a rise in the dollar that will break this system. Not a low in the dollar. If the dollar goes down, everybody's fat and happy. Emerging markets can issue more debt and more people will buy it. If you take the dollar up, what happens? They can't pay back their debts. You now have emerging market crisis, as we're seeing just as in Turkey, just for an example. That's what will break the monetary system. If you look at it, it was the dollar going up to all-time record highs. And that's why Roosevelt confiscated gold and he devalued the dollar. The dollar went up to all-time record highs again, 1985. What did they do? They had the Plaza Accord, created G5, and that's where the U.S. government and told Europe they had to create the euro. They needed competition to stop the dollar from going up. U.S. always wants a lower dollar. Europe always wanted a higher currency. So we're undermining the very foundation upon which everything exists, and that is basically governments and pensions and et cetera. Once that confidence is undermined and people begin to realize, hey, you know, there isn't anybody really in charge, you know, then it's Katie bar the door. Then I think we'll probably see some sort of monetary reform, another major crisis in that area, but to get to that, it has to be a higher dollar, not lower.
It just seems, though, with the Fed changing gears, 10 years almost of expansionary monetary policy, now to a contraction, there'd have to be some type of reverberation throughout the domestic economy as a result of that contraction in monetary growth and spending. And you seem to think, for the most part, we're the least sick patient in the ward.
True, but plus also that money was never getting into the economy.
Yeah, sitting on institutions' balance sheets.
Yeah, and you look at, I mean, excess reserves. I mean, just look at this. You're saying you want to stimulate the economy. Then the banks say, well, we don't have a place to put our money because we really don't want to lend it to anybody. So you create excess reserves, and we'll give it back to you. Oh, okay, that sounds good.
Do you see bubbles bursting, though? I mean, we've got that S&P Case-Shiller looks a lot more toppy than it did in 2006. As you said, equity is reaching record highs. This seems bubbly, but from your perspective, this thing can run on a lot longer than most people think.
If you look at it, all right, you have me on the show because I'm one of the few people that's been bullish. Virtually more than 90% of people out there, oh, it's going to crash, it's going to crash, it's going to crash. This is all they've been saying since it's this whole thing has started.
Not since 2009, to almost 10 years.
You know, this is the most hated bull market in history. When you reach a bubble, it's only when everybody flips and says, that's it, it's always going up. We haven't reached that point. And if you look at, you know, retail participation, it's still, you know, we are 50% below 2007 levels. Nobody's been buying us, per se, in that classic rush to the bubble type thing. Even if you look at, we have charts on our site, it's armstrongeconomics.com, of the P.E. ratio, all right, going back throughout history. Where is the peak? It's at the bottom in 2009. Why? Why would the P.E. ratio reach 120 at the bottom, not at the top? because at that point in time, you don't know what's happening. So you basically just want to make sure that you get your money back or as close to it as possible. That's why even T-bills will go slightly negative at the bottoms. You're willing to pay just to park your money. All this nonsense that, oh, the P.E. ratio, you know, the dot-com was 50. It was 120 at the bottom in 2009. Dot-com bubble was 50. We have a long way to go before you ever get to any historical highs on all that nonsense. And it gets to a point, the question is, do I just want my money back or am I going to make a profit on this? We haven't gotten to that question yet. When that does come and it's government that you're worried about bonds collapsing and who's going to be able to pay their debts, etc., then equities is the only place to go. For big money, I'm talking about. The individual, yeah, he could buy gold, etc., and, you know, and things of this nature. But the type of things that survive are tangible assets. Even if you look at Germany, when they had, you know, the hyperinflation was over and the new currency came out in 1925, what was it backed by? Real estate. They didn't even have any gold. So tangible assets are what survive. Real estate, that survived.
Exactly, but right now it's FOMO, fear of missing out, that's winning in the equities markets. And do you like for folks to have some diversification? Do you like the modicum of precious metals in their portfolio?
If you're talking about, you know, buying physical metals and keeping them, you know, basically in a shoebox or whatever, that's fine. All right? You're not trying to buy the high and sell the low. You have to understand that, you know, yes, some diversity is good, even at having some cash around, honestly. You know, you have Europe. I mean, people are stockpiling cash. They're not putting in the banks. The number one thing that everybody's buying is home safes. So you want to be able to definitely diversify to some degree because you never know what the governments can do. And at the very end, they can always, you know, freeze accounts and things of this nature, brokers or whatever. So we're not at that stage yet. At that point in time, maybe you want to start looking at cashing some stuff out. But the main thing about the equity market, even the politicians are invested. The only time I get calls from politicians in Washington is when the stock market goes down. Real estate crash, etc. If you look at it, you can probably Google it. You'll see real estate did not decline in Washington, D.C. You know, it's a endless supply of employment money, so it's outside of the norm. So they walk around, they go, what are all these people complaining about? I'm fine. Let the stock market go down, then I get a phone call.
You love equities right now. Would you throw anything else into that portfolio?
I think, like you said, we're in this consolidation period where the markets are trying to come up with what to do. Just so much political chaos everywhere that it's like, well, gee, if Trump's in trouble, do I go to Europe? Well, Europe's in trouble, so where do I go? Well, okay, Trudeau doesn't look so great over there in Canada. Britain's going through an exit. It's like, okay, where do I go? Bangladesh? So this is why things are choppy right now. Stock market may have reached a temporary peak, go back down for a couple weeks, you know, and back up again. I mean, this is what's going on. As we get closer into the November elections, then you're going to see all kinds of chaos. And what's happening there is very disheartening as well. I mean, all this stuff about Trump, you're basically saying, democracy, who needs it? If it's against me, I don't like it. Kind of like Stalin said, you know, who cares about what you vote for? It's the people who count that determine elections.
You know, we need a blockchain-based, encrypted voting system.
They don't want to do that. I mean, well, then you'd actually have maybe a legitimate system. I mean, you know, Mark Twain, I thought, said it very, very best. He said if voting really mattered, they wouldn't let us do it. The hatred out there is just unprecedented. Still have an election, but they're a little rigged and stuffing people that they want. I mean, you know, they don't understand what this Trump revolution is about. People didn't vote for Trump because they liked him personally. All right. They voted him in because they basically didn't like everybody else. And it's the same trend we're watching everywhere you go. Mexico, you know, over in Malaysia, they just threw out the president. It's happening everywhere. It's just an uprising because the way politicians have been running everything since World War II, it's pushed the envelope to the end. So it's not even a particular philosophy. I mean, if Mao comes to power on the other side, then you have FDR. So it's not even a philosophy. It's whoever is in, throw them out.
The traditional mantra in political circles is if the economy is pretty solid, if we can believe the numbers, unemployment at 10-year lows, pretty solid GDP, then it's the status quo and it's the incumbents who stay in place. That wasn't the case this time.
Because a lot of other things are working here, and that is like pensions are not being, you know, being dishonored, etc. They keep raising the age limits on all sorts of things. It's just really a rigged game. Socialism is collapsing, and all the promises that they made are just being tweaked constantly. It's absurd, and it's hitting many people in many different areas. You had Hillary to get the her and Bill. Basically, they just had a sign on the White House, you know, for sale. Highest bidder. So you had the bankers basically come in and say, all right, fine, I'll tell you what, we'll create the student loans that you want. However, you're going to eliminate any rights to go bankruptcy. So they say, oh, okay, fine, we'll do that. And then what do the bankers do? Then they come in and they want the parent to co-sign for the student loan. Now suddenly the bankers have a piece of the action on your house, and you can't even declare bankruptcy because it's a student loan. These are the things that are really disheartening. And yes, unemployment is low, and because it's hard to find good people, honestly. And at the same time, you have Forbes coming out and saying 65 or 60% of the students who graduate can't find a job. It's just the way it is.
As we wrap up, I understand you had a big meeting in Frankfurt. You had a seminar there. I hope that went well. And do you have anything else planned?
Yeah, our next one actually is our annual conference in Orlando. That's mid-November. I mean, they're kind of like mini UNs. I mean, there's more than $1 trillion in the room. I mean, people are flying in from all over the world. They're very interesting because you get to see the capital flows right then and there. They're very good. We have a cocktail party so everybody gets to mingle.
Well, folks, put that on your calendar. You got to jot down Martin Armstrong's next seminar, November, Orlando, Florida, United States.
Yep, we do one in the home ground. We are international. Our clients are global, not just domestic. You can't look at just a single market. You can't.
Okay, any other contact information for the folks today?
Basically, our website is free. We do it as a public service, actually. It's armstrongeconomics.com. Search countless topics.
Martin Armstrong, always a pleasure.
Well, thanks for inviting me.